Hello, I'm Lionel Boney and I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Lionel.
Good evening, Daniel. We are in Penny, where the pasta comes from.
No.
I'm just getting an early one in for Corrections Corner. It's not where the pasta comes from, but it is spelt the same.
No, it's not. Well, it is spelled the same, but it's not where the pasta's from.
No, it's not. But we are, well, we're in our little rest day hideaway, aren't we? I've certainly spent...
about Penny pasta last night on the way back. Not your favourite. I hope we've got questions about what's our favourite kind of pasta.
We haven't actually, but let's kick that one off. I mean, the reason I'm not a big fan of penne is I think it's ubiquity in kind of mid-range restaurants in Britain. It's the kind of the go-to pasta, isn't it?
You made some comment last night about how it doesn't hold the sauce, or it does hold the sauce, and I was thinking, well, it was completely validated by your revelation from earlier in the jury that you just tip the sauce on top of the pasta, which is an absolute heresy.
Yeah, but I then stir it in.
What on the plate?
Yeah, in the pasta bowl. No.
Oh dear. How many jiri have you done now?
Well, this is the third in, well, a couple of weeks of the last three. Yeah, this has been the rest day here at the Giro. We're doing something slightly different today. We don't normally do an episode on the rest day, but we are opening up...
we get paid extra for this?
You'll have to talk to your agent about that, Daniel. Yeah, we're opening it up to listeners' questions. This is the Cycling Podcast press conference. We'll be taking questions and comments that have been phoned in on WhatsApp. If you want to get involved next time, because we'll be doing this again next rest day, and maybe again after the Giro, I can see... Daniel, just think of the extra payments, Daniel. Come on. You'll be absolutely rolling in it by the end of the Giro. You can join the fun by sending us a voice message on WhatsApp by dialing +44 797 133 8205. That number is also in our Twitter bio at @cycling_podcast. You can leave us a message, and if you're on Wi-Fi, obviously it doesn't count as a phone call and all of that. Keep the messages short and the questions succinct, and we will endeavour to play as many as we can next week. This week's episode, we're going to play a selection of the comments that have come in. As this is the first week, we really didn't know what to expect, but we've got enough comments and questions to be going on with, so we will do that. But first of all, Daniel, just let me know, what have you... I've not seen you all day since breakfast.
I've been busy. Well, before breakfast I went for a run, then had a very quick breakfast, then I went off to Sky's hotel, had a brief audience, exclusive audience, and we should really, you know, there should be all sorts of fanfare about this. It was exclusive at the Team Sky hotel,
with
quizzed Chris Froome about Italian football. Only, I mean, not sort of apropos of nothing. This the cue for this, the prompt was the fact that I did the interview in a little area of the hotel where there were signed Italian football jerseys hanging, some illustrious names. You're gonna have to wait until tomorrow's episode to find out how the quiz went down. But it wasn't all tomfoolery. I did have some serious questions for Chris, very serious. Then I went for lunch with... Well, I listened to Thibaut Pinot talk about the Giro. Then I had lunch with Pinot, but it was his brother. It was the cannoli guzzling coach of Thibaut Pinot, his brother Julien. We're a long way from Sicily now, so not many cannoli to be had here. And from there, I went to the Mitchelton Scott Hotel. Listened to Simon Yates' press conference. Had a word with Esteban Chavez about the Zonkerland next week. You might hear that later in the week. And then I had a very long and fascinating conversation with another member of the Mitchelton Scott team. And you might hear most of that later in the week.
Fascinating. Blimey. Yeah, I mean, you're putting me to...
Some batteries. I bought some shampoo, you know.
Wow. Wow.
Anyway.
No such thing as a rest day for Daniel. My day, by contrast, was pretty restful. I had a very long, leisurely breakfast. I then gave a long interview to a journalist writing a business feature about the cycling podcast. Extraordinary stuff. I mean, yeah, that was quite enjoyable, quite interesting, got me thinking. Hope I didn't drop you two in it with any of my on-the-record quotes. Yeah. And then what did I do? Well, I did a load of admin. You know, I'm doing the boring sort of backroom stuff today, Daniel, you know, sort of the things that just keep us on the road, you know. And then I also went for a shambolic run, walk, run. And then I came back here and waited for you. And now we are on our, we're outside our delightful rest day accommodation, which is called...
Dolce Far Niente.
Dolce Far Niente. Sweet something.
Literally sweet to do nothing.
Sweet basically. To do nothing.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I've lived up to that more or less today. Brilliant. Well, let's see what the listeners have got in store. As I said, people have been phoning in their messages. We've also got a few emailed comments to read out. But let's kick off with the first question, please.
Hi there. This is Andre from Costa Rica, but living in Madrid. I wanted to ask you guys about the format of the tours. I really enjoy following them. However, it's quite hard. They race during working hours in Europe. And also, the races tend to be way too long and not that action-packed. So I think it's difficult for the fan base to grow when the tours, which are the major events, are quite hard following. Do you think this is something that has to change in order for the sport or its fan base to grow?
Well, first of all, hello to Andre. I'm very flattered to have a Costa Rican listener living in Madrid. The timing of races, stages, it varies a bit from country to country, race to race. There are a few countries where the stages finish noticeably later than others. And Tour of Switzerland is one where the stages finish very late. Tour de Romandie is another, so there's a theme there, and Swiss races tend to do that. Others, like the Dauphiné, for example, finishes incredibly early. That's because Roland Garros, the French Open tennis, is on at the same time. I agree with you. I think it would be ideal if races finished at about 6 or 7 o'clock for television. Practically, that comes with a few complications. It comes with complications for the teams, and from a selfish point of view, it comes with complications for us. No journalist is particularly enamoured with the fact that the last stage of the Tour de France now finishes at about 8 o'clock, which looks great on TV. It's a better slot for TV, no, not great for us. The other issue of whether moving the time slots would grow cycling's audience, as we've discussed before, I think there is this idea in a lot of cycling fans' heads, and sometimes our heads, that cycling has this huge potential that's not fulfilled at the moment. I'm not sure that's the case.
You think it's about the size that it could be, maybe 10% bigger, 15% bigger, but not you know, exponentially huge.
No, I don't think so. You know, it's expanding in terms of the fact it's globalizing, but there tends to be a bit of a carousel as far as professional cycling is concerned. A country that has a big rider at any given time, or a Tour de France contender, tends to have a big market, and that market then tends to fizzle when that rider ends his career. A couple of exceptions. Denmark was an exception after Bjarne Riis's Tour de France win, and I think the United Kingdom will be an exception.
I say this every time we're kind of asked this question or a variation of the question, but the Grand Tours, if they didn't exist, they wouldn't be invented now for the very reasons you say, Andre. Nobody's at home during the day to watch them. Everyone's at work. It's notable that in recent years, certainly, well, the last 20 years, the big mountain stages have tended to be coincided with the weekend, or in the case of the Tour de France on Bastille Day, July the 14th, for very obvious reasons. But I think we need to be careful what we wish for here, because there's something, you know, I'm going to get called up by the epic police here, but there's something sort of grand and epic about the Grand Tours. They unfold over 3 weeks gradually, they reveal themselves gradually, and you need the sort of you need the dull days to amplify the exciting days. And I think if the kind of unfolding soap opera of the Grand Tours is lost, it won't be recovered. So I think we, you know, certainly in the case of the Giro and the Tour and the Vuelta, cling on to that for as long as possible. Lionel,
do people still go to work, or do they just go and sit in an office and mince about on the internet and stream bike races anyway?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, from the last time I had a job, I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Anyway, next question, please.
Hey, guys. Woke up today and was hoping to find the new episode in my feed, my podcast feed, but it's not showing up. So just wondering what's up with that? I was really hoping to get to listen to episode 7 this Saturday morning.
Oh dear, Anon. Had it been a heavy night before you phoned in that message? Well, all I can say is if you want to make sure you don't miss an episode of the Cycling Podcast, subscribe on one of the many apps. If you've got an Apple iPhone, the podcast app. If you're struggling, generally, if you sort of pull down on the menu and let go, that will refresh the feed. And if you're still struggling, delete the feed and re-add it, and your episodes will show up. And if all else fails, you'll always be able to find the episodes on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com.
A San Francisco.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Good morning, my name is Jaap from the Netherlands. I'm a friend of the podcast, and I have a question for you, Daniel and Lionel. I'm very amazed by the performance of Max Schachmann of the Quickstep team. Obviously, I saw him finishing in the Flèche Wallonne, but before that, I didn't even know this rider. Looking at his results, he seems to be very new and young. I was wondering, how does Quickstep get all these big talents from all over the world to their team? And is it a surprise that he's performing so good at this Giro? Thank you. Keep up the good show.
Well, yep. Schachmann is one of several real success stories among the younger riders at Quickstep at the moment. They have been fantastic at picking up young talent for 3 or 4 years now. I think that coincides with their recruitment of Machin Fernandez, who is now actually working for UAE, but he was employed 3 or 4 years ago by Quickstep as a scout. He'd previously been a direct sportif at Sonia Duval and Mapei and a couple of other teams. But they took on Machin, and it raised a few eyebrows at the time, because a scout is not... Well, I'd never heard of a professional team having an appointed scout before. It tends to work pretty informally in professional cycling. Everyone knows everyone, but they also have their networks. As I say, quite informal. Machin spotted some fantastic riders for Quickstep, the Colombians Gaviria and Hodge, for example, and Narvaez that they've picked up this year from, well, he's an Ecuadorian rider. So the sort of Hispanic or Spanish speaking riders Machin was particularly focusing on, but there have been other success stories like Schachmann, Remy Cavagna, who's gone there this year. Another great advantage for Quickstep is they have an incredibly international staff. And this reminds me a bit of HTC High Road. They deliberately tried to represent pretty much the whole of the cycling world in their staff and their direct sportifs. And this helped them have those networks that I talked about across different continents, different countries, and consequently they knew an awful lot about what was going on in those various areas, and they were able to identify good under 23 riders and juniors very early. And Quickstep have this pretty much the same setup, various nationalities represented among their direct sportifs, and even the riders themselves help a team in identifying young talent. Often they're the best talent scouts of all. They know the juniors that are coming up. They often train with young guys, and that's happened on a large number of occasions. I can't think of an example at the moment, but it's a very common
I also thing. Think that Patrick Lefebvre, the ultimate boss of the Quickstep team, he reminds me a bit of a cycling equivalent of Sir Alex Ferguson, when Sir Alex Ferguson was manager of Manchester United, in that when a rider gets too big almost, he's quite happy to let them go if they don't fit into the wage structure. I mean, he could well have kept Marcel Kittel had he wanted to, but rather than sort of bust the bank, if you like, let Kittel go and let the green shoots of the riders coming up behind take those places. It's a smart strategy, and it's one that's developed over 20 odd years. It isn't something that just sort of popped up overnight.
Hi guys, it's Michael Thompson here, friend of the podcast from Johannesburg in South Africa. I just wanted to say thanks so much for the wonderful coverage so far. It's been absolutely brilliant. I think today's stage with Etna is going to be incredible. Hopefully we'll see if Chris Froome has any form in him this year. And absolutely can't wait to see the battle between him and Tom Dumoulin. On that note, I loved your interview with Tom Dumoulin yesterday. And yeah, just please keep up the great work. I'm absolutely enjoying it. Thanks. Bye. Hello, just a nomination for Pedaleur de Charme. I think Simon Yates definitely deserves some recognition. I think generally he's a really classy rider, but his performance on Etna yesterday really just sealed it for me, and I think I'd like to nominate him, please.
Thank you very much, Michael. Yes, Etna was good, wasn't it? It was certainly better than last year's stage on Mount Etna. Well, we now know who did well and who didn't do so well there. And as for your comment about the Pedaleur de Charme, yes, Simon Yates definitely does deserve some recognition, but he has the recognition of leading the race. He has an even more prestigious jersey.
Bigger? More prestigious, you think?
I think it's close, but I think the pink jersey is slight. It's certainly more. It's been going longer. Let's just say that. But the Pedaleur de Charme is slightly offbeat recognition. It's
a bit
not
opaque, isn't
it's,
it?
It's got that indefinable quality of Pedaleur de Charme itself, hasn't it?
Susceptible to corruption?
It's
very opaque.
We could test that, couldn't we, over the next couple of weeks. But no, it's for, if somebody's in a leader's jersey or has won a stage, they kind of unofficially exclude
them. Themselves.
Yeah, they disqualify themselves by being, by having some real success in the race.
Hi guys, my name is Niall and I work for the charity Pancreatic Cancer UK. Lots of us in the office follow the cycling podcast, cover the Giro. So I just wanted to ask about the pressures of wearing the pink jersey. Obviously, it's a positive thing to wear it, but it also brings additional demands like interviews and media limelight, etc. So do you think there's a psychological aspect to wearing and keeping the pink jersey, which Simon Yates will have to contend with given that we're so early in the race still? Or do you think that a Dumoulin or a Pinot will in some way be happy not to have that additional pressure for the minute? Thanks, guys.
Thank you for your call, Niall. And before I answer the point that you made, good point, you work for Pancreatic Cancer UK, and I took part in a training ride on Saturday with some of the riders who are doing Ride London in aid of pancreatic cancer. I mentioned on a podcast a few weeks ago that my mother passed away from pancreatic cancer, and I've got a little bit involved with Pancreatic Cancer UK, and it was great to meet all the people riding Ride London. And they do fabulous work. It's a very tough cancer, pancreatic cancer. So good luck to all of you who are riding Ride London for Pancreatic Cancer UK. In terms of the point that you raise about this onerous responsibilities that come with wearing the pink jersey, I do always wonder about that, because you know, a rider in the leader's jersey at a Grand Tour can be, you know, 2 hours or so doing dope control, interviews, going around basically answering the same questions from different journalists in what they call the mix zone, doing the broadcast interviews, and then appearing in a press conference for the journalists. And it must be quite mentally draining. I think some riders deal with that better than others. It's interesting for Simon Yates, because he's not a natural kind of sort of garrulous extrovert speaker. It's not something he's maybe all that comfortable with. And it'll be a very good experience from him from that point of view. But the point, I think, the main point is that when you're in the leader's jersey, you know, that they say it gives you wings. I think it's a great position to be in, especially in a team like Mitchelton Scott, where there are effectively two leaders. Simon Yates in pole position within his team and in the race. He's got time over the others. They have to catch him. And as racing in Grand Tours gets kind of closer and closer, that's not to be underestimated. And, you know, there is pressure, there are responsibilities that come with wearing the jersey, but I think that most riders would take that.
Nice to hear from the Buffalo there. He'll be back out here at the Giro, won't he, Richard? He arrives on Friday evening, I think, for the jets back in for the two big mountain stages at the weekend, Monte Zoncolan on Saturday, of course. Well, we can't wait.
We'll hear the thud of his hooves from about Thursday, won't we?
I'm not sure about that. He's very, very deaf these days.
He's slimmed down a bit, hasn't he?
Hi, my name is Orlando Shorter. I'm a friend of the podcast. I live in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. I'm apologizing in advance if this message sounds a bit garbled. I'd like to comment on something that people find very strange here in Brazil. First of all, that you guys have been very good on this subject, which is Chris Froome's salbutamol case. And I think you've been very balanced and very sympathetic in a good sort of way, without losing sight of journalistic qualities and keeping true to the subject. I'd like to read a quote from Velo News, which are your colleagues from across the pond. Things could not have started worse for Team Sky's star. He endured a withering half-hour press conference where he was hammered by the scandal-hungry British press. Doesn't it strike you guys as strange that it's some of the British press that seem to be leading the charge against Froome? I mean, I'm not saying that they have to, all of them, be sympathetic to him, but, you know, I mean, they could be a bit less viciously critical of him. Not you guys. I think you guys are very balanced. But other people, there's a bit here. You see, people abroad don't get this, but there's an anti-Murdoch subtext that people outside of the UK don't get, you see, so it's strange. I don't get how some journalists who've written fawning, sympathetic books about Simpson and Merckx are so critical of Froome from the very start. I mean, I think, you know, being an expat all my life, I kind of detect a sort of strong anti-colonial viewpoint. This because Froome is a Kenyan expat. Anyway, this is just my point of view. I don't know if you guys want to comment on this or not, but I think it's very, very strange and very distressing to see him getting such a hard time from the press from his very own country. And people here in Brazil, for instance, do not comprehend this at all.
An interesting point that, Orlando. I don't know whether there's an anti-colonial viewpoint to it at all, or whether, but I do certainly think that Chris Froome hasn't cemented his place in the hearts of the British media and the British public, perhaps because, well, he didn't do the rounds, did he? I know this sounds really simplistic, but after his first Tour de France win in 2013, he perhaps should have spent a week or so doing all the obvious stuff in the UK, going on BBC TV and radio and what have you. And he really didn't, possibly because his personality doesn't lead him that way. He doesn't sort of seek the spotlight in that way. As for the story itself, well, it obviously is a big story once it had been leaked. I mean, we could talk about the fact that the salbutamol adverse analytical finding should really have all played out confidentially, but obviously didn't because of a leak. But once that leak had happened, it's obviously a story that the media, ourselves included, are going to cover. No two ways about it.
Yeah, and I would make a point I made before in the podcast, just that the British press doesn't have a kind of deeply rooted culture of covering professional cycling. It has started really showing a lot of interest in it in the last few years since Britain has been very successful. Countries or nationalities which have a kind of deep hinterland of covering professional cycling also have a deep hinterland of covering doping scandals, and there's a certain pragmatism that has grown over the years in those places, a certain world weariness, and maybe a greater ability to put things in perspective. And I think, you know, I'm not suggesting this is the case with our colleagues in the media, but I think there's certainly still a kind of false equivalence drawn, a false association between whether it be the Froome case or other cases that aren't clear cut, and they're not about steroids, and they're not about blood transfusions, and they're not about growth hormone, with cases that have been about those substances. Like, you know, I always think that The real sort of eureka moment for the British public and the British media was Ben Johnson testing positive in 1987. And sometimes I think that the sort of ability to put doping stories in context has not really changed that much since that moment. And, you know, maybe that's a good thing, because maybe we should be morally very, very heavy-handed with doping cases and doping stories, and it should be total outright condemnation from the start. Maybe that's a path towards cleaner sport. However, I personally think there are certain cases which demand a slightly more nuanced approach, or a wait and see approach, and I think the Froome case is certainly one that demands a wait and see approach.
Yeah, I think the unfortunate thing is that EPO and salbutamol are being put in the same bracket, and they just don't belong in the same bracket at all. You don't have to have studied doping in cycling for 20 odd years to know that. It's just obvious. Having said that, it's interesting, in response to our interview with Dave Brailsford, which we played over a couple of episodes during the week, a few people, you know, taking issue with the fact that Dave Brailsford said that they believe that Froome is 100% innocent. And somebody said it made the... drew the comparison with the drink driving limit, and it's very different to that, because the drink driving limit is determined on the amount of alcohol in the breath / blood sample, depending on how far a case goes, not the amount you drank. So it's not about the amount ingested, it's about the amount in the sample. The salbutamol limit threshold is the absolute opposite. The rule is based on how much was taken. The threshold that shows up in the urine sample, it's almost like a sort of amber flag. And the adverse analytical finding is a, hang on a minute, what's going on here? You now have to explain this. And if the explanation is adequate, and all of that process happened behind closed doors, then, you know, nothing goes any further. And there have been cases of that. I mean, I don't know any actual specifics, but everyone you talk to says, well, these cases do exist and have come up. So that's, you know, it's important to sort of try and keep the substances and the situations in context and in perspective. But having mentioned Dave Brailsford, let's hear our next comment from Phil.
Hi there, my name's Phil. I'm a long-term friend of the podcast, and I'm loving your coverage of the Giro so far. I've just got a quick request for when you have an interview with Dave Brailsford. Instead of playing it out, could you just give us the headlines? He seems to be getting more and more vague as time goes on, and you get what I believe is called a word salad for about 5 minutes with really no discernible content. So anyway, keep it up. Loving your work. Bye.
Well, Phil, I like the phrase word salad, and I know exactly what you mean. And I sort of sympathise with you there, but, we did our best by trying to boil Dave Brailsford's comments down to the most interesting and most salient
tried to
points.
Take them out of context as much as possible, didn't we?
Well, you know, next time we're going to get Cassette Boy on it and just get it really chopped up. Now, let's go back to the start of the Giro. Of course, the Grande Partenza was in Israel, and Richard and I went to Israel. We covered the three stages there, took the race from Jerusalem to Eilat via Tel Aviv and a couple of other places. A really fascinating weekend. We obviously covered the race there. We made a Kilometre Zero episode there, which was the first of our series, and it generated a fair bit of feedback.
Good morning, gents. It's Ben Miller calling from the sunny Chilterns this morning. I've got a question for you for your press conference. Without wanting to drag us all over old ground, been reflecting a lot on the start in Israel. And the past week has shone on a light what really awful racing it was there. And that seems to be a trend of these foreign starts. The stages are particularly bland and particularly dull, so that as time passes you don't actually remember the race, but you do remember the country. And we won't really remember the two stages won by Viviani in the time trial, but we will remember Israel and the site and the controversy and the storyline around it. My question therefore is that success? Are these international starts all about the country, and maybe the racing is deliberately bland to not get in the way? Or is it a missed opportunity for the organisers? I just want to congratulate you guys for tackling an incredibly difficult subject, the Giro start in Jerusalem, in an incredibly balanced, even and thought-provoking way. I recognise it's potentially a no-win subject for many people, but RCS have undoubtedly brought politics into sport, and I'm really pleased that you have not shied away from that fact and have presented it from many different perspectives. I think Lionel's voice in particular has been compelling and engaging and balanced and insightful on this. So a massive well done, and I look forward to hearing the Friends podcast on it in a few days. Keep it a good work, chaps, and enjoy the road south.
Hi, Lionel, Richard and Daniel. It's Michael Thompson here from Johannesburg in South Africa. First of all, I'd like to thank you for your fantastic coverage. It's absolutely indispensable listening for me as a cycling fan. I think now that the Israel portion of the Giro has come to a conclusion, I think it's only fair to pass congratulations on to the race organizers as well as to the Israeli authorities for holding such a peaceful and well-organized event portion in their country. I think that it was obviously everyone's concern for security that no violent events or anything like that would take place, and I think it really went off well. And for me, the best part of it as a cycling fan is to see how many people came out and watched the race, and the joy and the excitement that I observed in the crowds, the huge numbers of people, even out in the middle of the desert. It was absolutely fantastic to see. The other thing is, here in South Africa, quite interestingly, we've got quite a large Jewish expat Israeli population, and they have a community radio station here that does cover sport, the larger sports, but they never really cover cycling at all. And in the build-up to the Giro this year, for the last few months, the whole season really, they've been starting to cover cycling more and more. And listening to their coverage last week and the build-up to the race beginning, it really was fantastic to hear how cycling has embedded itself as a sport in the local community. And hopefully that'll continue. But I just made the observation that you're taking a chance by holding the Giro in a place that's never really held professional cycling races on this scale has really affected people on the other side of the world and has really helped promote the sport in a good light, and I think that's fantastic. Anyway, keep up the good work, and I look forward to the rest of your coverage.
Hello, this is Simon Seymour-Dale, friend of the Cycling Podcast. Just finished listening to your Kilometre Zero on the thorny topic of the Giro in Israel. I think the Guardian columnist was spot on when she said that sport can't ignore politics. On the other hand, I think Amnesty International is naive to expect cyclists to make political statements while they're competing in something like the Giro. The best point was made by the British guy that now lives in Israel, that there was a missed opportunity for sport to send the message that sport brings people together by having either the Israeli team incorporate a Palestinian or by the Giro insisting that a Palestinian team perhaps compete in the Giro and not do so overtly as a political statement, but just let it happen and let people see that competing together and doing sport together reminds us all that we're human beings first and only by chance are different nationalities. Thanks for a great podcast, guys. Cheers.
Well, a few points there on the Israel start and our Israel coverage. And we got, you know, obviously quite a lot of feedback on that in emails as well and on social media. I came straight home from Israel and I'm rejoining the Giro at the end of this week, week two. So I've had some time to reflect on it too. The first question I should answer wasn't in those questions that we heard, but a few of you have asked me about my exit interview, which Lionel mentioned on the podcast. This was quite an unnerving experience at the airport, where I was held up for about 40 minutes and had my passport taken away and studied. It did strike me as odd that it was so easy to enter Israel and so difficult, apparently, to leave. But I was asked a lot of questions about previous visits to the Middle East, where I'd stayed, who I spoke to when I was there, no idea, where I visited, that kind of thing, whether I had any Facebook friends in Doha, which was a very specific question. It wasn't particularly pleasant. It never is when you feel that you are being grilled, which I did feel. But then, of course, there are lots who argue that security is tight because it needs to be. It's something that Sylvan Adams, who brought the Giro to Israel, said in his comments in our Climb to Zero. Michael Thompson makes the point that the stages passed off without incident. They were safe. They were well organised and successful from that point of view. It should also be said that the transfer back to Italy seems to have been very well organised. I spoke to a couple of teams this week, Education First and Team Sky, and they were full of praise for RCS. They said it was exceptionally well run, with no real glitches, which I must admit has made Lionel and Daniel's stories from this week of shambolic transfers and cable cars down mountains all the more amusing and a little bit strange. It's strange that the Giro can get everyone from the Middle East to Sicily very easily, but struggle to get riders off a mountain in the middle of Italy. Those are the technical aspects, though, of the Giro start. The political context is the one that a lot of people have obviously got in touch about. It's so incredibly complicated that we decided in the Climb to Zero that I mentioned earlier to, rather than to reflect on our own experiences there, to hear the points of view of various people with very different perspectives. So we had Israelis, some people who live there, some cyclists, Sylvan Adams, who I mentioned. And we heard from some of the other riders in the race and also from some Palestinian cyclists who were taking part in an alternative Giro. And I hope that people found it interesting and thought-provoking. It did highlight a sort of aspect of being a journalist that I get a little bit irritated by sometimes, the pressure to come up with an answer and tell people what to think. And I think the role of the reporter is to report and to give people information, to try to inform them, but not tell them what they should think. This goes to our reporting of cycling as well, which is obviously far more frivolous and doesn't matter to the same degree as things matter in Israel, but it's the same principle. I think this was a whole other level of complicated, though. And as I speak today on Monday, on the 14th of May, it is, today is a big day in Israel with the American embassy opening in Jerusalem, which is highly charged, and protests at the border with Gaza, where a number of people have been killed and injured today. So the story just goes on there, unfortunately. And of course, there was the question of whether we should steer clear of politics altogether. But as Simon says in his message, it was difficult in this case. And it's difficult in the case of cycling and in the case of Grand Tours, because they are about geography and borders. And so, having stages taking place in Israel, you couldn't separate that from the political context. To Ben Miller's point, it's not uncommon for the early stage of a Grand Tour to be a little bit uneventful, shall we say. But I'd say the time trial in Jerusalem was interesting, certainly. And stages 2 and 3 had their moments. The move by BMC to put Rohan Dennis in the pink jersey, that was certainly noteworthy and deserving of great praise, I think. But it cast my mind back to other starts of Grand Tours in other places. One of the stages into Yorkshire was very good, the one that Vincenzo Nibali won into Sheffield, that's very memorable. Don't remember much about stage one, really, apart from the crowds, and I certainly don't remember much about the stage into London. Same year start in Northern Ireland of the Giro in Belfast and then on to Dublin. Great days, great support, fantastic crowds, but the races themselves, I remember Marcel Kittel winning. I remember Dan Martin falling off. That's about it. Utrecht, nothing much to report from Utrecht. Apeldoorn, not apart again from the great crowds. Dusseldorf for the Tour last year, pretty disappointing. I mean, we sort of ease into a Grand Tour, I think, and the stages, there's a rhythm to a Grand Tour, and it helps with that rhythm, that these early stages, from a racing point of view, are pretty uneventful. They do serve another purpose, I think, and that is to showcase a country and to give people who live locally a chance to come out and support something, a bike race. And of course, in some of those places I mentioned, they have done that in huge, huge numbers.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Independent research shows 10% of sports nutrition products would get a professional rider banned. Trust Science in Sport, the world's highest standard of banned substance testing.
As expected, a lot of reaction to our coverage of the Giro in Israel. Chris wrote to say, "Have you really agonised and wrestled about following the Giro to Israel? I've never heard the term sport washing apply to any of the desert races before now. More a jolly discussion about how good the hotels are, but no mention of the construction labour. Keep on sport and leave the evils of Israel to our leader of the opposition." Thank you for that, Chris. And Rod writes, "I think you do a wonderful job, but I feel in your podcast on the start of the Giro in Israel, you could have mentioned the lack of moral doubts in visiting such beacons of democracy and human rights as Qatar and Russia. So I agree that Israel should be held to high standards, which unfortunately it does not always reach, but so should other countries." And Aidan writes, "Hi guys, I felt the kilometre zero on Israel was a bit too pro-Israeli, didn't show much balance. Not so much sport washing, but maybe a light rinse." Fair point. But the difficulty was finding the voices to provide the balance. You know, there's not many Palestinians actually, you know, around that we could have spoken to. That's kind of the whole point, the segregation. We did our best by getting a contribution from people doing the ride in Palestine.
Well, online, I listened to it as a punter. I wasn't there. And I thought you did a fantastic job, if I may congratulate you.
Crikey.
And I thought you were very brave in taking on an issue which most people decided not to tackle, either by not going or by focusing on the sport and going with the Giro's line, which was that sport and politics shouldn't mix. And I thought that you guys really tried to strike a balance and represent a bit of what you saw. It would have been naive to think that you were going to come away with a 360 view of the situation there. I mean, we had various comments in private, and also I think we mentioned on the podcast from people saying that you could study the situation in Israel for a year and still not really know exactly who was, well, you know, to what extent each side was in the wrong and in the right, but you know, we tried to be sort of honest and transparent about the fact that, you know, we wanted to find out more and we didn't know that much about the situation, and it was a bit of an education for us as well.
Well, it certainly was. I mean, it would have been very easy to have stayed thousands of miles away and stuck to my my preconceptions and the opinions formed by the UK news coverage and what I'd read online and elsewhere. Going actually opened my eyes to just what a complex situation it is. I think anything that sort of brings you up close with the reality of that it isn't black and white in all cases. There's just so much intertwined in that situation. We're never going to solve it by going to Israel to cover the Giro. But
and we are a podcast that, you know, I think it's obvious from what we do that we like to look kind of slightly, well, our current Giro series is called 40 Pista. We do like to take a kind of slightly left field view at times. It's not just about racing, whether it be about food and travel. So it would have been disingenuous for us to say, no, we're only going to focus on the racing. But as I said, you know, we're not war reporters, we're not political correspondents, and practically speaking, in the time you spent there and the time we had available to broadcast, it was only ever going to be a sort of a light overview and a provocation. You know, hopefully it provoked a bit of thought.
Indeed. Now back to the Giro. Daniel, that is the wonderful Amalatera, our Giro theme music. The song is Kotze.
Yeah.
Okay. And, tell very, very briefly.
Right.
Who are Amalatera?
Well, they're a band that we got to know a couple of years ago. We needed a Giro theme tune. And You got on the old Google, didn't you? Yeah, I think I did. I was living in London at the time. Richard lives in London. I happened upon this act that was London-based. They were the only act playing a particular kind of southern Italian folk music in the UK. They were mainly playing a kind of music called pizzica music. The origin of the word pizzica, pizzicare kind of means to, well, it can mean to nip or to bite. It was called pizzica because the music originally, I think centuries ago, people started to make this music in Puglia, so the heel of Italy, and it was said that by kind of shaking in a particular way to this music, you could somehow sort of disperse or draw the venom from a snake bite.
Was it a spider bite?
No, it's a spider bite. You're correct.
Yeah, all right. Sorry. Live corrections corner.
So if you watch Amaraterra perform any of their music, you'll see this kind of very vigorous shaking. A lot of the time, shaking of tambourines. But we thought it was very, very evocative. It was very different from a lot of other Giro theme tunes. And, you know, we came to love it. And we've had great feedback. And, you know, I know Richard has had discussions with the chaps of Amaraterra about concerts we might arrange in future or events, and
they may well join us on an event, or maybe more than one event later in the year. Amaraterra, AmaraTerra.
What does that mean, Lionel? Literally?
Well, terra, earth, ground. Yep. Amara,
bitter.
Love of.
Bitter.
Bitter Earth.
Yeah.
Ah, nice. Yeah, so Amaraterra, the song Kotze, C-O-Z-Z-E. That's the main theme. We also use some of their other music in Kilometre Zero and various other places as well, as and when. If you go on YouTube and type in Amaraterra Kotze, you can actually see the band performing it in, I think, an Italian delicatessen in London. Great performance of it. Stand by later in the year. Hopefully we can make that happen. We've been trying for a while to coincide dates, but you know, they're very busy, and our dates tend to be sort of fairly fixed, so stand by.
Guys, Pablo Gomez here from Austin, Texas, Colombian, living in the States. I have a quick question. What do you guys think about the Mitchelton Scott strategy with Chavez and Yates? I'm always a little bit skeptical from those double attacks, you know, having two leaders, not a defined capo for the squadra. What's going to happen there? Are they going to fight it out between the two of them? Is Chavez going to help Yates? Thank you.
I think that Mitchelton Scott are in a very strong position at the moment. They're in by far the strongest position of any team in the race. They're the only team in the race with two potential winners of the Giro at this point. Their leaders are both going to be heavily handicapped by the time trial, the long time trial, well, longish, 33 kilometres around Trento in a few days. But I don't think, I haven't detected any sign of discord in the ranks. They've raced together, the Yates brothers and Chavez have raced together for 2 or 3 years now, both or all three with ambitions of stage wins and general classification victories or podium finishes, and it's never really got competitive and bitter, and I think that's going to continue. I think in that team, people might roll their eyes and they might think it's a bit of an Aussie sort of caricature, but I think there really is an excellent team spirit in Mitchelton Scott, and I think they've got a great sort of admiral or captain of the ship in Matt White.
So Philip Brunel in L'Equipe writing that it was almost treachery that Simon Yates almost stole Chavez's thunder on Etna.
I love Philip Brunel, and he's someone who in some respects I aspire to be like, but he did write a book suggesting that Marco Pantani had been murdered, and he also wrote a book suggesting that Lance Armstrong might have used a motor from between 1999 and 2005. I don't really believe in either of those hypotheses. Do you, Lionel?
No.
Hey, Cycling Podcast. My name is Paul Keller. I'm an American living in Catania, and I'm really excited. The Giro is going to be in Sicily next week. A longtime listener of the podcast. You guys do a great job. Be curious to know where you will be doing your podcast when you're in Catania. It'd be fun to swing by and say hi to the crew. My question is, or what I'd be interested to know about, is about the North Americans that are doing the Giro this year, like Michael Woods and Joe Jombrowski, Nate Brown, Chad Haga, just to get their thoughts on what it's like to do the Giro this year. And so if you could get any interviews with them and put them on your podcast, I'd appreciate it. Thanks for all your good work. Bye-bye.
Well, Paul, we didn't actually do a podcast in Catania because that was where the stage start was. So we were actually recording at the other end, which was, oh heavens, where was that?
Caltagirone.
Caltagirone. And who won there? Basolin, yes. Okay, good. And as for the Americans, well, we've spoken a fair bit to Michael Woods, Canadian. You said North Americans, not Americans.
Forget that he's from Canada. Made that mistake once.
We've spoken to Mike Woods a couple of times, but yeah, you're right. It's the 30th anniversary of Andy Hampson's win. It might be quite nice to ask the likes of Joe Dombrowski, Nate Brown and Chad Haga what that means to them. Whether, I mean, they're all too young to have remembered it.
Yeah, really. I mean, current riders, there are a few exceptions, but current riders are generally not that great on their cycling history. I asked Thibaut Pinot today what Laurent Fignon represented for him. Laurent Fignon being the last Frenchman to win the Giro d'Italia, unfortunately died a few years ago. Thibaut Pinot was very sketchy about when that might have been. He thought it was 1985, then 1987. I had to correct him, tell him it was 1989.
Hi, Cycling Podcast. Thanks for everything you do. I have two messages. One, I just wanted to follow up on the EF Education First crowdfunding. I dobbed in a significant amount and I'm delighted with the feedback they've had. It's been excellent from top to bottom, really responsive, helpful. I just received my shirt yesterday. The second thing is, I'm interested in the riders who ride a la Zubeldia. I'd love to know more about, is it Ben O'Connor of Dimension Data and other riders like that? What's their experience of a Grand Tour? I'd be really interested to have a kilometre zero on that. Cheers.
Great to hear a reference of riding a la Zubeldia. For those who don't know, this is something we coined a few years ago. I think I might have pinched it, actually, from our colleague Ed Pickering. I think he may have been the originator, but we culturally appropriated Ed's phrase and put it on a T-shirt. And then once it was on a T-shirt, it belonged to us. I think that's how it works. No?
Similar thing happened with Cadel Evans' nickname. I was once attributed with coining Cadel Evans' nickname Cuddles on Wikipedia and all over the internet, in fact. It was Andy Hood.
Oh, well. Andy's very good about these kind of things, isn't he? He's not gonna take exception. But a la Zubeldia means basically riding semi-anonymously into the top 10 places, typically the lower portion of the top 10. You mentioned Ben O'Connor there of Dimension Data, had a very good day on Etna. Now getting slightly deeper into the Giro, it's finding exactly what it means to ride a Grand Tour. This is his first Grand Tour, of course, so it's a bit harsh to describe a first-timer as riding a la Zubeldia. A la Zubeldia is really a sort of a veteran's sort of trick. It's a bit like a cricketer staying at the crease for a long time without scoring many runs or drawing too much attention to himself. But a good idea, a kilometre zero on riding a la Zubeldia. Maybe Richard and I will do that at the Tour de France. I think editorial director Freeb has got kilometre zero plotted out for the Giro.
Well, it's a bit. I detect a bit of bitterness in that line.
No bitterness at all. None whatsoever. I'm enjoying the ride.
Could all kick off between you and me in the next few days, couldn't it?
I'll wait till the buffalo's back.
Why are there no great groups of people on the internet rolling their eyes every time another Quickstep rider picks up a win in this spring classic season? These seem to be the same kind of people who would get pissed off if Sky smash out every Grand Tour sitting on the front, doing exactly what they're paid for and what's expected of them. As far as I'm concerned, Quickstep have got the same kind of idea, but they just apply it in a different way. They've got a specific goal, the budget to achieve it, and they recruit riders who can make it happen. Why does one seem to be more acceptable than the other?
It's a very good point that dominance draws the ire in some cases and not in others. And it's interesting to sort of understand the reasons behind that. I suppose there's been this kind of myth that's grown up that you can win, you could, even in the era of heavy duty doping, the classics were somehow untouched and that you could win the classics because they were only one day, whereas the Grand Tours were absolutely out of reach for clean riders. And that wasn't the case then. And so I think the classics riders do get an easier ride.
And I think, going back to the question about the media, I think it's the home media of a team that will kind of light the bonfire under a sort of that a firestorm of speculation. Mm. And the Belgian media is quite grizzled, world-weary, pretty pragmatic when it comes to doping and doping suspicion. And they haven't really shown much interest in suggesting or speculating that there's anything untoward going on.
Wow.
A quick step. And, you know, we don't have any elements to suggest there is.
No. Like, really. And also, I mean, they've got a roster of riders. I mean, they've got a very strong team of riders, and they built that team and developed riders as well. And, you know, that's what they do. I think you'd probably, if they started smashing the Grand Tours as well, then it would be legitimate to sort of raise both eyebrows, perhaps. But that's not the case. Last question.
In a recent episode, Daniel implied that he didn't feel comfortable calling the Tour of the Basque Country Zulia, and kind of implied that English speakers shouldn't call the Tour of Flanders De Ronde, and, you know, all that kind of thing. And with that in mind, what do you guys think about the kind of vague cultural appropriation of the Tour of Yorkshire being officially called the Tour de Yorkshire, especially given that the last time I checked, Yorkshire was definitely not in France? And is this made any better by the fact that the Tour de France and the Tour de Yorkshire are both run by ASO? I don't really think so. I think it's pretty embarrassing to even have to say the words Tour de Yorkshire, let alone market a race under that banner. But yeah, interested to see what you guys think.
Good question. And a lot of people are aggrieved at this, and it jars slightly with me as well. However, when I went to the Tour of Yorkshire a couple of weeks ago, I had a bit of an epiphany. I think it was in a conversation with Ned Bolting, TV commentator, colleague at ITV. We were talking about the fact that the Tour de Yorkshire is brilliant at attracting casual fans to the roadside. And I think by their own admission, a lot of these casual fans don't really watch any of the cycling at all. And on numerous occasions when I was in Yorkshire, I heard fans or people working in shops where the race was passing say things like, "When is this Tour de France thing finishing today?" Which suggested to Ned, and when I think about it, it suggests to me that this kind of cultural appropriation or linguistic appropriation of French names has helped on some level plant the idea in people's head that this race is in some way connected to the Tour de France, or might even be a successor to the Tour de France.
Well, when you're trying to attract a big audience, that's a smart play, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I can see you wincing every time languages are mangled. I mean, time I try and say something Italian, I mean, the scowl.
Nonsense, I mean, I'm not a big fan. There's a women's race in Australia that's called the Giro. It was at the start of the season, a women's stage race. I'm not a huge fan of that kind of thing. I mean, Nah.
There we are. Well, while we're doing Corrections Corner, last night in the podcast I said that as a Venn diagram has to have three elements to it. It doesn't. They just have to have overlapping elements where they're things that are in common. So it could be 2, 3, 4 and so on. Sorry about that. I can be wrong on all manner of subjects. Not a problem. But Daniel, you were also wrong in our pre-Giro episode when I asked you, I put you on the spot, is the time trial a wine trial? And you said no.
Well, it is, in the sense it goes through a wine region, but they're not calling it the wine trial. The wine trial, they're calling it a wine stage. There's a lot of good wine from there.
Yeah. Franco Zanoni wrote in and said Vino Santo, sweet dessert wine from there.
No. Vin Santo's from Tuscany.
Oh, well, you and Franco can take this up.
No, I'm afraid not, Franco.
Anyway, The Trento region has its own brand of sparkling white wine.
The wine stage definitely has is definitely a region that's well known for its Franciacorta.
Okay.
In the Franciacorta, sorry.
Okay. Guy Fazio writes in to say how much he likes the podcast and also very proud of Sicily. And I feel slightly guilty here because we focused quite heavily on the negatives, scruffy elements of Sicily.
And I don't know, we were just unlucky because speaking to various colleagues over the last few days, some people had fantastic things in Sicily.
The countryside in the middle, stunning. And the food, excellent.
Yeah, and the people were very friendly in most cases.
Brad Morrison says, love the podcast. Was just wondering if you could give a message of congratulations to my cycling podcast mad friend, Luke Cadman, and his wife, Cheryl, who have just had their first baby boy today. I'm sure he'll be listening whilst juggling nappies on his turbo trainer up in Stirling, Scotland. What an image, juggling nappies on a turbo trainer. Well, congratulations, Luke and Cheryl. Hopefully your baby boy will grow up to be interested and passionate about cycling. Dave Owen writes to suggest that we should be pitching a TV show, a Giro podcast-style TV show with cooking segments, 10 minutes on the stage and then 45 minutes on location with the food and drink. Go on, pitch it. It would be massive. No complaints from me. He's suggesting calling it the Not-So-Hairy Cyclists. Plus Buffalo. This is a serious one from David, who asks about the break on the stage to Mount Etna, why it took almost 40 kilometres for the break to form, and how come riders as good as Esteban Chavez and Sergio Henao got into it. Now, I've talked a bit to Matt White about this, because David asked, he basically said, I don't really understand the psychology and dynamics of how breaks form. Well, on a day like that, the identity of the riders who get into that break is absolutely crucial for the outcome of the later stages. Yeah. The big teams would not want to have to be chasing anything, so the fact that so many riders from big teams got in there was really significant.
It's a domino effect, isn't it? It only takes one. It takes one big rider to decide that they want to get into a break, or for a team to decide they're going to put a prominent rider into a break, and then everyone else is almost condemned to do the same thing.
Exactly, or chase it back down and stop it. And that's why it took 40 kilometres for the break to form. It's why it went on a climb, so that the strong climbers were able to get into it. If it had gone on the flat, you would have had a selection of, the lesser ranked riders. You know, somebody from Androni, of course, and you know, Velia, and maybe Israel Cycling Academy, and perhaps, certainly not climbers of the likes of Chavez and Henao. And it would have just gone away, and all the big teams would have gone, that looks all right, we'll let that go, no problem. But as soon as one big name rider, dangerous looking rider goes across, they either have to shut it down or send somebody up. And on this occasion, enough teams sent somebody up that it was a really strong, powerful break. Tom, well, he speculated that Chris Froome is riding this Giro to recreate the environment of the Vuelta a España as part of his defence against this adverse analytical finding for salbutamol. I understand that definitely isn't what's being done for a number of reasons, not least one being that if they were to demonstrate that there could be a spike in the salbutamol level, Chris Froome would then have two adverse analytical findings on his hands, not just the one. So that's not really a practical way to fight the case. Somebody's asking for us to talk more about the lesser competitions, teams classification and some of the other classifications. We will do that on a quiet day later this week in the Giro. And finally, Richard Stuckey asks, what does the phrase road captains mean? Hears it in the podcast sometimes, but what does it mean? Daniel, very, very quickly.
Well, it's a good question. It's quite oblique. I think it varies from team to team, but it's basically someone who takes charge of... it's the first point of call for the director sportifs in the peloton. It's their link man. It's their sort of ambassador in the peloton. In some teams, not everyone likes to have a radio, so the onus for communication in the peloton is then on the road captain. And you know, some decisions simply can't be made in dialogue with the team car because radios are still pretty poor. 15-20 years on from when teams first started using radios, the quality hasn't really improved that much, so often riders can't hear what's being said. the TVs on in team cars are on a delay. Often there are things happening that aren't captured on the TVs that the direct sportives are watching. So there really has to be someone in the peloton who can take split second decisions on behalf of their teammates, and that's generally the road captain.
Thank you very much, Daniel. Well, that's a selection of your questions answered. Hopefully we've done a reasonable enough job of that to give this a go next time. We will be asking again for questions, but if you want to phone in your question via WhatsApp, well, the phone number is at the start of the episode, or it is in our Twitter biography at cycling_podcast. More questions next week on the rest day, and we will be back tomorrow with analysis and discussion of stage 10, Daniel, won't we? So
yep.
Until then, thank you very much.
Been a long old rest day, not very restful for me.
I feel absolutely rejuvenated.
All right,
thank you, Daniel.